Matthew 28, and we'll be there in a few minutes. Every single one of us knows what it's like. I want you to think about a time in your life when you have been on a mission, when you have had something in your life that you have pursued so intensely that it consumed your life. Maybe it was a degree in school. Maybe it was the pursuit of someone that you loved. Maybe it was creating something new. Maybe it was getting something that you've been saving up for. When I think about this idea of this kind of passion and intensity, I think about the movie Rudy. If you've never seen the movie Rudy, it's about a young man who wants more than anything in the world, literally more than anything in the world, he wants to play football at the University of Notre Dame. He endures all kinds of opposition, discouragement, and obstacles. He orients his entire life toward this one purpose, and he doesn't give up. And he finally makes it into the University of Notre Dame, and he tries out for the football team, and he makes the practice squad. And for years, he spends his days practicing, getting beat up by big scholarship players and kind of being a punching bag for the team. But it's an inspiring story because in spite of all the opposition he faces, he does it. And at the end of the movie, a spoiler alert, but the movie's been out for 20 years, so you've had time. He gets to go into the final play of the final game of his last year. And on the last play, he sacks the quarterback. And if you want to see my wife cry at a sports movie, all we have to do is cue up this scene where Rudy tackles the quarterback and the crowd goes crazy and his family, who doubted him all along, is there and cheering him on. And his teammates lift him up on their shoulders and they carry Rudy off the field, the only player in Notre Dame history to be carried off the field. You'll see, like, not just like, oh, that's a sweet story. I'm talking like ugly cry, okay? Not that there's an ugly cry for Beth Hadley, but you know what I'm saying. We've all had something that we pursue. And the question that I think a lot of us ask ourselves on days when we turn inward, we ask ourselves this question: am I pursuing the right thing? Am I pursuing the right things? Another way we might put this question is this: am I on a mission that really matters? Francis Chan says that our greatest fear in life should not be one of failure, but of succeeding at things in life that don't really matter. Am I on a mission that matters? That's the question that we are trying to ask here at this church in this season of our history. Are we on a mission that really matters? There are all kinds of missions that churches have, and just a few that I would mention. Some churches have a mission to be big. Other churches have a mission, believe it or not, to be small. Some churches have a mission of being cutting edge or relevant. Some have a mission of having the best preaching or the best worship or the best programs. Some have a mission to be the most biblical or some other identifying quality in their community. Most churches, I believe, have good intentions. And it's not that any of those missions that I just mentioned are inherently bad things. But what we're asking today is, what mission matters most? And what we're saying here at the South Baton Rouge Church of Christ in this season of our history is that for us, we want God's mission to be the mission that matters most in our lives. It's not so much that this church has a mission. The real question is whether or not God's mission has a church, has this church. Think about the language in our vision. I'm going to share it in a second if you don't remember it, but I want you to think about it and reflect on it, the language of what it means to embrace God's mission. We aren't creating the mission. We aren't building the mission. We aren't spreading the mission. We aren't designing the mission or manufacturing the mission, because we aren't the authors of this vision, of this mission. God is. And so the question is, will we embrace God's mission. What is God's mission? God is on a mission to reconcile and redeem all things through Christ, to put everything back together again, to bring about a new creation. And in Matthew 28, after Jesus has been raised from the dead, he gathers his disciples together with him. And it says that some, even though they worshiped him, some doubted. And even in that context of some doubting Jesus, Jesus gives them this mission, this great mission, this great commission, as it's called. And so let's read along. You can read on the screen if you choose. Matthew 28, verse 18. Then Jesus came to them and said, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you. And surely I am with you always, to the very end of the age." Jesus tells them, "You've followed me. You have seen the life I have lived. You have seen the ministry that I have carried out to proclaim good news to the poor and sight for the blind and freedom for the oppressed and for the prisoner. And now follow those teachings and teach other people to live that way. And baptize them. Call them to allegiance to God alone. And do this always from this day forward. And know that I'm with you." He says it a little bit differently at the end of John's gospel. John quotes Jesus as saying, again, Jesus said, "Peace be with you. As the Father has sent me, I am sending you." As the Father has sent me, I am sending you. That word "as" can be intimidating in this context. It doesn't just mean, hey, God sent me, so now I sent you. But we might read into that, in the same way that God sent me, I am now sending you. Which means when we see the way that Jesus lived and the sacrificial cost to his life and the way that he gave of himself at his own expense and the way that he served others instead of seeking to be served, and the way that he seeked and saved the lost, and the way that he became the greatest servant of all. In that same way that God sent Jesus to do those things, God now and Jesus now sends us to live in that way in the world. And so, our vision, this third part of our vision, boldly embracing God's mission. Again, this is available on our website. I want to encourage you to go read the whole thing, but this is the summary of this part, and then I'll share some specific emphases that have been listed. God is on a mission to rescue, redeem, and restore all things through Christ, and we boldly join God in his mission. We want to have hearts that break for what breaks God's heart, and to pursue the acts of justice and love, of mercy that God desires. We commit to join together the varied gifts, talents, and resources that God has given us individually to build up and prepare the body of Christ for these works of service and outreach to which we are called. We earnestly embrace the Great Commission, doing whatever it takes to share and embody the gospel for all the world. I know that we've talked about this before, that if you ask someone to give their life to a story that's not big enough, they're probably not going to follow. And what I love about this vision that I believe that God has given to this congregation is that this is big. This is demanding. This is daunting. But it's worth giving our lives to. Some things that I want to point out, and this is in the list that's included in the fuller version of the vision that's on the website. We will be characterized by an outward focus that seeks to reach and bless our community. That's what embracing God's mission looks like. We will be a church that aggressively points the unchurched and the next generation to Jesus. We will be committed to doing all things with excellence. We will have a reputation in our community of generosity, being those who bring hope and empowerment as salt and light. And we will be a church where young and old are encouraged, expected, and assisted in discovering their vocation and giftedness for service in the kingdom. There's more that we could say, and there's more in that list of some indicators that we might see if we boldly embrace God's mission. But I want to point us to four sort of values that I see in this mission, in this vision that God's given to us, sort of guideposts, signposts along the way for embracing God's mission. And the first one is this: inside and outside. When it comes to faithfully living out God's mission, being inside means going outside. Being an insider is all about being with and even becoming the outsider. Pete Rollins tells a story in his book, The Divine Magician. He says there's an old Irish story that tells of a competition that asked people to construct the largest possible sheep pen using only a limited set of materials. And three people from the area entered the contest: an architect, an engineer, and an old farmer. On the day of the event, each one of them was given some basic tools, a pile of wooden planks, and 24 hours to complete their pen. And when it came time for the judges to decide the winner, they began by examining the architect's work. She had used her extensive knowledge of buildings to construct an impressive circular structure that maximized the utility of the materials. Nothing was wasted, and 100 sheep could easily be held inside. Next, they looked at the pen that was created by the engineer. His was more simply constructed, but four times the size of the architect's, because he had also used all of the material, but had spent his time studying the strength of the wooden planks and worked it out so that he could split all of them in half without compromising the integrity of the enclosure. Last, they came to the old farmer, who, in contrast with the others, was surrounded by unused planks piled in a heap and large bags of nails, and they watched in disbelief as the farmer carefully stepped into the 2-foot square box he had made. And they and all the people who were watching laughed and said, "That's it? That's your sheep enclosure? A 2-foot box?" He said, "You couldn't even fit one sheep in there." He said, "Oh, no, you've misunderstood. I'm on the outside of the enclosure. You're all on the inside of the enclosure." See, what he had done is he had flipped the tables. He had created this tiny little space where he belonged and made it so that everything outside the fence was where everyone else belonged, where all the sheep would belong. And I love that story because it encourages us to think about the fact that when we become part of God's family, insiders, God's children, that comes with it a fundamental call to see a world in which we are willing to be the outsider for the sake of other people becoming insiders in God's family. Will we be willing to go to the outside, to go to the margins, to live as outsiders so that outsiders can become insiders? Paul says it this way when he writes a letter to the church in Corinth in 1 Corinthians 9, verse 19 through 23. He said, "Though I am free and belong to no one, I've made myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible. To the Jews, I became like a Jew to win the Jews. To those under the law, I became like one under the law, though I myself am not under the law, so as to win those under the law. To those not having the law, I became like one not having the law, though I am not free from God's law, but am under Christ's law, so as to win those not having the law. To the weak, I became weak to win the weak. I have become all things to all people, so that by all possible means I might save some. And I do all of this for the sake of the gospel, that I may share in its blessings." The second signpost that I want us to pay attention to is this: mission calls us to mission over method. We should always be asking the question of whether our methods draw us deeper into God's mission. If they don't, then we have an obligation to re-examine our methods and maybe even change our methods for the sake of the mission. And if that sounds unpleasant, maybe it is a little bit unpleasant, but it doesn't compare to the great joy we will have in seeing new people come to Jesus and to recognize God's goodness. What a great joy that will be, that will override any discomfort that we have to endure when we re-examine what our methods are in reaching people. Giving up our comfort is a small cost. And so I have some challenging questions that are personal to us, that have a little bit of an intended edge to them for us to consider. Do we like our own personal preferred worship style more than we love the lost? If sitting in rows undermines our ability to connect with one another, do we value learning in rows more than we value each other? Is our comfort with a predictable order of worship more important to us than whether this next generation remains engaged? Will we continue to watch our young people leave before we consider that it might be time to change some things? In some churches, people might say in response to this idea of mission over method, over my dead body. But the tragedy in those churches is that over my dead body isn't a threat as it is as much a self-fulfilling prophecy. Because in churches where people are guardians of their preferred methods over mission, by the time the next generation is done burying us, it will be too late. And they will have already given up on this heritage or found another faith community or left the faith altogether. And if it's God's mission that we value above all else, then allowing that to happen on our watch will become unacceptable to us. Mission over method means we value who we might reach more than our personal comfort. Let me say that again. Mission over method means that we come to value who we might reach more than our personal comfort. The third thing that I want to bring out of this mission is that it's a come and go mission. Jesus says, come. Come to me, those of you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. When he's calling disciples and one of them says, you're from Nazareth. What good can come from Nazareth, from a place like that? And Jesus just says, come and see. Come and see. There's a place for coming. And a lot of churches, though, spend most of their time, most of their energy, most of their budgets, most of their resources, most of their people, most of their energy and passion in getting people to come. And again, that's not necessarily a bad thing. There is a place for coming and being part of this. What we do here in this space during this time, it matters so, so much. And what we do as we prepare ourselves to go out and live faithfully in the world, it matters, and we ought to keep doing that. This is why the writer of Hebrews says, don't forsake the assembly. Don't give up meeting together. It's too important. What we're doing here is too important. Come, and let's invest resources in inviting other people to come. But if all we do is focus on come, we miss the chief verb in the Great Commission, which is not ask people to come, it's go. Go. So again, the question is not, does this church have a mission, a missions program, which we do? Do we have a mission to reach people, which we do? Do we have a mission to bring people here and for them to engage in this community? Of course. But it's not our mission, it's God's mission, and God's mission invites us not to just ask people to come, but to come, for us to come and go. We aren't called to camp out, circle up, and convict or convince. We're sent to serve and join the one who came to seek and save. And the fourth thing that I want to point out is that this mission invites us to have broken hearts and strong backs. We want to have hearts that break for what breaks God's heart. And if our heart is in tune with God's heart, there's a sense in which we will carry with us through this life a deep sense of sorrow for the ways that the world is not as it should be, even in the midst of all that there is to be joyful about. But we can't just go through life sad. We must also have strong backs. When Jesus is about to ride into Jerusalem on the back of the donkey, coming as the King of Peace, and a week later to his death on the cross, he's on top of a hill that overlooks Jerusalem, and he sees the city and he weeps. Jesus weeps over Jerusalem. But then, a week later, he carries his cross on his back and he dies for Jerusalem. And he invites us, the way of the cross invites us to think about how our sorrow at the world is broken can lead us to a deeper resolve to shoulder what we can and to stiffen our backs with all our strength, all the strength we can muster, and to carry the burdens of those around us. If the wheels of injustice are to be broken by the proverbial wrench, then may we lay our bodies and our lives on the line. That's what people who are cross-shaped do. And that's what a church does that embraces God's mission. Broken hearts and strong backs until our dying breath. When you look at the world around you, I'm sure that you're like me. You see things that break your heart. Maybe even things that make you angry. Especially if it involves someone being mistreated or left out or put down or left without a basic need. And it makes you angry. And you say to yourself, you hear a voice inside that says, that's not the way things should be. Somebody ought to do something about that. And you need to know that in that exact moment, when you hear that voice, somebody ought to do something about that, that you have played right into God's hand. And I think he just is standing there, arms folded, laughing and shaking his head and waiting to see what you will do. Because the moment that that voice in your heart sees something in the world that needs to be redeemed and restored, and you say, somebody ought to do something about that, God says, I'm so glad that you volunteered. When we hear that voice, whatever it is, that ought to be a signal flare, an X marks the spot kind of moment, letting us know that this perhaps is a place where God has called you or me to live into something that we've been created for. There was a story in the LA Times this past fall about a man named Mohammed Bazik. And I want to read you a few excerpts from the story. The children were going to die. Mohammed Bazik knew that. But in his more than two decades as a foster father, he took them in anyway. The sickest of the sick in Los Angeles County's sprawling foster care system. He has buried about 10 children. Some died in his arms. Now, Bazik spends long days and sleepless nights caring for a bedridden 6-year-old foster girl with a rare brain defect. She's blind and deaf. She has daily seizures. Her arms and legs are paralyzed. Bazik, quiet, devout, Libyan-born Muslim man who lives in Azusa, just wants her to know that she's not alone in this life. I know she can't hear, can't see, but I always talk to her, he said. I'm always holding her, playing with her, touching her. She has feelings. She has a soul. She's a human being. And there's only one person like Bazik in Los Angeles County. If anyone ever calls us and says, this kid needs to go home on hospice, there's only one name we think of, said Melissa Testerman, a DCFS intake coordinator who finds placements for sick children. He's the only one that would take a child who would possibly not make it. The key is you have to love them like your own, Bazik said recently. I know they're sick. I know they're going to die. And I do my best as a human being and leave the rest to God. On a Saturday in early December, Bazik, along with his son, Adam, and the girl's foster girl's nurse, had a celebratory lunch for her sixth birthday. Bazik invited the girl's biological parents, and they didn't come. Bazik crouched in front of the girl, wearing a long red and white dress and matching socks, and held her hands, clapping them together. "Yay," he said cheerfully. "You are six. You are six. You are six today." Bazik lit a sixth birthday candle in a cheesecake and sat the girl on the kitchen table, holding the cake near her face so she could feel the warmth of the flames. And as they sang happy birthday, Bazik leaned over her left shoulder, his beard gently brushing the side of her face. And she smelled the smoke from the candles, and a small smile crossed her face. God is on a mission to rescue and redeem and restore all things through Christ, and we boldly join in God's mission. We want to have hearts for what breaks God's heart, and to pursue the acts of justice and love and mercy that God desires. We want to commit to join together the varied gifts, talents, and resources that God has given us individually to build up and prepare the body of Christ for these works of service and outreach to which we are called. We earnestly embrace the Great Commission, doing whatever it takes to share and embody the gospel for all the world. So, my dear brothers and sisters, may we have broken hearts and strong backs. May we boldly embrace God's mission. And may we see through the power of Christ the renewal and the redemption and the restoration of all things through his power, not through our own. A new creation. A world without end. And may those who have ears to hear the word of God. Let's stand and let's sing this song together.